Blog Talk Radio.
It's time to strap our boots on. This is a perfect day to die. Wipe the blood out of our eyes. In this life, there's no surrender. There's nothing left for us to do. Find the strength to see this through. We are the ones who will never be broken. With our final breath, we'll fight to the death. We are soldiers, we are soldiers.
I'd like to thank everyone if they have come from my friend Charlotte Dively's show, or if you've come from the or you're coming in for the archives. I thank you as well for coming in. But if you have not come from Charlotte's show, and that is Prophetic Art Class, you can find her on a Facebook application. Just go to your Facebook page, go to the search engine, and type in Newt Now as one word, NEWTNOW. And you will find a host of shows, including this one, and also shows such as Samuel Sanford, and also you will find Mark Prasik's shows, which is a live video chat. You'll find about six shows there, and I suggest and that you check those out as well. So tonight we are going to have Barbara Haney come in and talk about how the broker convention in the past has been successful for the Republican Party in the past. Now, Barbara Haney has attended the University of Notre Dame and received her PhD in public policy and taught economics while completing her PhD as a graduate student. She has served as a faculty member at St. Mary's College, Notre Dame, Indiana, McKendree College in Lebanon, Illinois, Eastern Illinois University, Washington State University, and arrived in Alaska during the Hickel administration to serve as a program director at the University of Alaska Fairbanks. She left the university service to exercise her citizenship to assist in the defeat of Governor Tony Nollens and later to assist in the election of Governor Sarah Palin. She worked on several state and local campaigns in the 2010 election cycle, including Governor Sean Parnell, Joe Miller, Steve Thompson, and Mike Kelly. Now, what I'd like to do to start off the show tonight is I have a clip here of Barbara Haney speaking about a broker convention, and she will be coming calling in later on. But until then, please enjoy and listening to her clip, and then later on you shall hear her live.
To our listening audience out there in Sumpter County and beyond, welcome to A Patriot's Voice for Freedom. We the Patriots want to thank you for tuning in to listen to WKFL 1170 AM Kickin' Country. We look forward to providing you with information on those issues we consider of vital and controversial importance, and invite you to join us in our dedication to fighting for the preservation of our country, our Constitution, and our freedom. We ask that you remember and pray for the men and women of the armed forces for their brave sacrifices they make to keep our nation safe from our enemies, both foreign and domestic. Today's show topic is on a subject that many of us are unaware of and many lack knowledge about. We hope to share with you information that will lead to a clearer understanding about what a broker convention is, and if we do have one, just how it will affect us as American voters. A Patriot's Voice for Freedom is honored to have as our guest speaker today, Barbara Haney. And welcome, Barbara. And before we get started, I would like to introduce you to our Patriot panel. We have online Donna Arthur. Donna is from North Carolina. And Valerie Kelly Bass. Valerie is from Florida. Lamusha Reed, and she is from, where are you from?
Alabama.
I'm from Florida. Stacy Coleman. Stacy, you are from?
Louisa, Kentucky.
Barbara is a private citizen who lives in the woods of Alaska and is a conservative Facebook activist who was impressed by Speaker Gingrich's resume and debate performance. After the Virginia ballot, she worked to get Speaker Gingrich on the ballot in Alaska and went and got signatures to get him on the ballot during below 54 cold snap. This was during the Florida primary. She volunteered to work for her regional primary preference poll. She attended the district convention and was elected district chairman and delegate to the state convention. She attended the state convention and was elected as part of a slate to be one of Alaska's two delegates for Speaker Gingrich. In addition, she has exercised her citizenship assist in the defeat of Governor Tony Knowles and later to assist in the election of Governor Sarah Palin. She worked on several state and local campaigns in the 2010 election cycle, including Governor John Parnell, Joe Miller, Stephen Thompson, and Mike Kelly. When there is not an election underway, she is busy putting in supplies for the winter, expressing her opinions to various political officials on pending legislation, promoting the ideas of free market capitalism, and generally being, in her own words, generally being a pain in the arse to liberals, D-I-R-T-S, all DIRTs and R-I-N-Os, Rhino. Welcome, Barbara.
Welcome,
hi,
Barbara.
I think I'm in the right place. DIRT is a Democrat. A DIRT is a Democrat and a Republican ticket.
On each of our panels to ask you questions later. But what I would like for you to do, if you could start us out, and in layman's terms, to make things very simple for those in our listening audience to understand more about a broker convention. I know I
sure.
know very little, and I am anxious to learn.
Okay. A broker convention is very simple. It's when they go to the convention, and on the first ballot, the nominee does not have the, quote, presumptive nominee, if there is one, doesn't have enough of a vote lead to be the nominee.
Okay, so on the Republican side, you're saying Mitt Romney.
Right. Well, he would be the presumptive nominee, right?
Mm-hmm.
Now, sometimes there isn't a presumptive nominee. In 1952, going into the convention, Eisenhower had 592 delegates, and Robert Taft had 500, just a little over 500 delegates. That was a dead heat going into that convention. So, you know, there wasn't really a presumptive nominee in the same way. But there's been many instances in history when we have had a, quote, presumptive nominee that blew it big. And starting in 1860, really in the very first Republican convention, you had a nominee who was presumptive nominee and technically speaking, had the delegates to pull it off on the first ballot. Though when he gave this horrendous speech on how wonderful Syria was, or so. I keep looking for the text of the speech, and I have yet to find it. But in the accounts of the speech, I've read something about he was talking about how wonderful Syria was and a few other things, and it turned out that he was just not what people thought. And they were furious on the convention floor, and they just started back and anybody became anybody but Seward. And you had this tall, kind of gawky, quiet guy named Abe Lincoln with a very questionable political past. I mean, he hadn't held a lot of offices. He was pretty quiet. He was kind of tall.
Sounds familiar to me.
Kind of dorky looking. And quiet, thoughtful. Didn't have a Harvard education. Didn't have a Princeton. No, Seward had a Princeton education. Abraham Lincoln was self-taught. He was homeschooled. Okay, very deep thinker. I actually spent some years living right down the road from the Lincoln cabin when I lived in Illinois. Very rather austere circumstances, but nevertheless, he ended up being a pretty good president, and he was the dark horse candidate. I mean, nobody expected Abe Lincoln to come out. Pardon?
Dark horse candidate. What does that mean for our listening audience?
A dark horse candidate is like somebody you're not even remotely expecting. like, oh, he doesn't have a chance kind of candidate.
Okay.
You know, not very well known, et cetera, all that good stuff. I think there's a lot of fear about brokered conventions because of 1940. And actually, that is not your typical convention at all, so I don't want to talk very much about it, but I can at the end. But if you go back and you look at the history of some of the brokered conventions besides 1860, like, for example, if you take a look in the 1800s, it seemed like almost every other convention was brokered. And so, I mean, there's this general fear about brokered conventions because, you know, you don't know who's going to come out, you don't know who's going to win, and, you know, it could dry up funding sources. But I think a brokered convention is a good thing. You know, in 1876, this guy named Rutherford B. Hayes, okay, he was another what they call a dark horse. He was a last place finisher, okay. This guy named James Blaine was the presumptive nominee. He goes to the convention, he's got the clear majority. There's a few others. There's Oliver Morton from Indiana. There's Benjamin Bristow from Kentucky. There's Roscoe Conkling. That old Roscoe Conkling was a nemesis, was the enemy, sworn enemy of Blaine. And he was not going to let Blaine have it. All right, there was contention between Roscoe Conkling and James Blaine that was infamous. Conkling was your standard New York party boss, okay? And Blaine was former Speaker of the House. And a lot of people think that Blaine and Newt Gingrich are very similar, but actually, besides being Speaker of the House, they really are nothing alike. Blaine would actually, if you look at his policies, he's far more like Ron Paul than he ever would be like Speaker Gingrich. But nevertheless, they go in, they get in there, and it's just, boy, you know, the first ballot comes around, and Blaine doesn't have it. Nobody has it, really. Blaine has the biggest majority. But this poet named James Lowell had been really kind of taken with what Rutherford B. Hayes had talked about. And he started working the convention floor, and he got Conkling interested. He got some of those delegates interested. And at the end, on the seventh ballot, Hayes had it. Hayes got the nomination. And he went on to win the election. And,
wow, that is fantastic. Thank you for that information.
Okay, folks, and without further ado, I believe I have the woman you just heard on the other show. And I believe I have her live, so let me go ahead and let her in.
Hi, Bob. How are you doing?
Hello, Ms. Barbara Haney. I am good. How are you? Thank you for coming.
I'm fine. I was just listening to myself.
Isn't that interesting, hearing yourself on the radio? Sometimes I look over, like they do in sports, you know, I look over and listen to some of my previous shows just to kind of, get to glean some stuff from it. And it's interesting hearing yourself. And also I do rebroadcasts of previous shows on Friday nights and Saturday nights. Just in case anyone missed an interview or a promotion I'm doing for a book or something. But, you know, so it's interesting hearing yourself, you know, talking on a radio or anything like that.
Yeah, it is. It's kind of different. Of course, I did the production work on that clip that you did, too. So I'd heard it before, but just hearing it over Blog Talk instead of on the airwaves was kind of, I guess I have a different tonal quality of my voice in there that I didn't anticipate hearing. Anyway, so did you hear me talk about the next convention? I mean, I can talk about each one of these conventions in sequence in a way that perhaps few people can. I've spent hours and hours just reading through different transcripts. I had one of them that I read today. I really, in my heart, had been trying to place how to capture or how to classify the Reagan convention in 1980, because, you know, he was a presumptive nominee, but that wasn't a clean-cut convention as people might like to think it was. A lot of people might remember that convention in that Reagan, you know, all the other people had pulled out early on, not early on, but, you know, approaching the convention, most of the other candidates who were running against Reagan in the primary, dropped out. But at the convention, what happened, and I posted today the convention notes that the head of that convention had written up, and he has them online now, so people can read it for themselves and see that I'm not making this stuff up. What had happened is that Bush and some of these other candidates who are establishment candidates had decided to withdraw, and what they were going to do, because they couldn't beat Reagan, what they were going to do was they were going to go for a co-presidency. So at the convention, here the convention chair and Reagan, they both think they got this nice, smooth sailing convention going down, right? Mm-hmm. Well, what happens is Gerald Ford decides to step in, and he's going to take it away from Reagan by being the co-president on the vice presidential slot. So in other words, they would share power, right? And so Ford starts, you know, putting obstacles in Reagan's way at the convention. He says, well, you know, we could be co-presidents, you know, and running mate, and you're going to appoint this person, and you're going to appoint this person, and, you know, you'll be president, but we'll be co-presidents. We'll share it together. And, you know, Reagan had himself kind of trapped there, and the only way he had out of it was really to go with George Bush as the vice presidential nominee, running mate. But even as a presumptive nominee with tremendous popular support, the establishment will still attempt to do different things to maintain their control over that office. So this whole notion that people might have that they've given up on the White House, you know, they just want to control the seats of power in the Senate, you know what, I'm not convinced that's true. Because if that's true, why did they do what they did with the Reagan presidency, with the Reagan nomination in 1980, where they attempted to assert themselves into a co-presidential kind of position?
Mm-hmm.
I think they care very deeply about it. There's a lot of things that are at stake here, particularly with treaties and whatnot. And there are people in the Republican Party who are not pro-Second Amendment and who are not pro-life, although most of them are, I think, anymore. But there's a few that are not. But especially when it comes to the Second Amendment, when it comes to the First Amendment, and when it comes to a lot of other what I call little regulatory garbage that is just absolutely critical. So, in fact, today while we're speaking, there is a whole series of regulations being proposed in the state of Alaska that regulate things like the height of pigsties and stuff. It's just unbelievable. And they're still out there, and they're in the Republican Party, the Republicans. And you said then you marvel that these would be Republicans. Well, what they're doing is they are other businessmen, and they're proposing regulations whereby they can limit competition and entry into the market. So, you know, just because somebody's a Republican doesn't mean that they are for free markets. In fact, many of them are not for free markets. They see government as a way to give them a market share and to limit entry and to stave off potential market challenges. And they use regulation in government as a way to stave off those preemptive challenges. And so that's why, you know, you see this big contention and this big divide in the Republican Party. But onto brokered conventions. If you take a look historically at the way brokered conventions went down, I would say prior to FDR and after FDR, there's a very clear difference in style and approach. I think the last real brokered convention was really the only brokered convention that ended up in a major loss where the brokered person came out as the nominee, and that was Wendell Willkie. If we throw Wendell Willkie as kind of an outlier out, and I have many reasons to throw him out as an outlier.
Can you explain why he'd be an outlier? Because some people might try to contend that, you know, Romney would find himself in a position of being one such outlier.
Well, and, you know, there's a very big similarity in the message being given by Wendell Willkie in his speeches and Mitt Romney. It's startling. It's scary. I throw out Wendell Willkie for a couple reasons. First, we were at war. FDR was an enormously popular president. But Wendell Willkie actually was not even a registered Republican going until a couple months going into the convention. He had actually served in the Democratic Party as a delegate for FDR. So the whole notion of him running against FDR was clearly absurd. He had a cadre of people who would show up and be disruptive. They'd hold up signs and they would shout down people going, "We want Willkie, we want Willkie," you know. And there was the Willkie Revolution, right? And now that a lot of records have been opened since that time, there's a lot of people who argue, based on the historical evidence, that the British government actually propped up Wendell Willkie as a nominee to ensure FDR the win, because they really relied on FDR being in that seat in terms of negotiating treaties and whatnot. And Chamberlain wanted to make sure, I guess, or not Chamberlain, but there was a certain British Prime Minister, Winston Churchill, wanted to make sure his buddy FDR got in. Now, is that true or not? I leave it to historians to argue that point. There does seem to be some historical evidence, at least, to suggest that it's a possibility. But every time we let a non-incumbent just walk away with it through the nominating process, you know, it's not been a very pleasant thing. There have been a few of them that have won and clear wins. And I can tell you those presidents, and when you hear the names of those presidents, you'll go, oh, my gosh, we need a broker convention. Because there's a couple of presidents who did, indeed, win on a clear first ballot that were not incumbents. One of them was 1908, and that was William Taft. He was actually backed by the current sitting president, Teddy Roosevelt. Taft was so bad as president that Teddy Roosevelt actually ran against him in the next presidential cycle. Then there was Herbert Hoover in 1928, who had a clear first ballot win. I think everybody knows the story there. In fact, the Republican branding was actually rather tainted and ruined as a result of FDR for many years. The next was in 1988, George Bush Sr., and the other one was in 2000, George Bush Jr. And I would argue that the two Bushes, perhaps, now, don't get me wrong, I really like George W. Bush, okay? But there were
things... you're talking about the second Bush, correct?
Right. Well, both Bushes. They won without very limited... I mean, George Sr. did have some opposition, but it wasn't... You know, John Anderson wasn't a serious challenge, and John McCain actually... You know, he spoke at the convention, and I think might have even given the nominating speech, you know, with some kind of assurance of maybe some future support. I don't know. But, you know, neither John Anderson or John McCain were a very serious challenge to George Bush in 1988. And, you know, Reagan spoke, you know, at the convention and was generally supportive. So that pretty much gave it to him in a very real sense. But the problem was, you know, with George Bush, obviously, he got on the speech, he got on the helicopter Thanksgiving, you know, not even a year before his reelection. He was golfing, got off the plane, or was getting on the plane, and said, what recession? You know, because his advisors had changed all the economic indicators they were looking at. So based on GDP rather than GNP, it did appear there was not a recession. But all of America knew we were in a recession. And you could change the economic indicators, you could change the measures all you want. People could look around and see the truth for themselves. It's not just in the numbers, it's in what you see around you, you know. And that's ultimately the final judgment of whether people decide we're in a recession or not, is what people see around them, not what the numbers say. And that's why I'm always flabbergasted when economists try to change the numbers and argue a different scenario, because when you look around, you can see the truth. You don't need a barrage of economic indicators. George Bush in 2000, he probably had a very clear win, but he barely squeaked by in a reelection when he should not have. And I would argue that his branding actually got ruined by Paul Krugman, and it's been exceedingly difficult until 2010 for Republicans to be able to get out there and win. And I would argue that even now with the Republican win we had in 2010, the only way that win came about was because we had a change in the branding of the Republican Party through the Tea Party movement. If that change had not occurred, I don't think we would have had those wins. 2006 was really the result of the taint on the Republican branding done by Paul Krugman and others. And
can you elaborate some more on the taint that you're speaking of?
Yeah, blame Bush, right? The whole even if you talk to Republicans who are of the more of the Ron Paul setting, you know, they talk about Bush, and they slam Bush, both of them.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I personally like GW. I wasn't a big fan of George H., the elder Bush.
Mm-hmm.
I genuinely liked him. He was a very likable guy. And probably most of the things that happened in that administration probably were a result of Dick Cheney's influence there. But that is when you really started to see what I call the co-presidency movement really begin to take hold in the presidency. So, but yeah, those two guys had clear wins, but I would say that those were not necessarily wins for, they were wins, but they were not the kind of wins that would make it easy for Republicans for the next few years to be in office. They actually might have been better if they had not won in some respects, except their opponents were so bad that they had. But those are the only four that I can see that ever made it squeak through the nomination process clearly and still went on to win. The vast majority that go through the nomination process with a clear win on the first ballot have not been successful at all. And I could go back to James Blaine and start talking about him, or I could talk about Wendell Willkie.
A little bit about Blaine, because there's a quote that I used to, put was from George William Curtis. And through my understanding, Curtis left the Republican Party because he did not like Blaine's nomination.
Yeah. In 1940, was brokered. But if you go back and you look at, the next couple ones, Blaine on his third run. We could talk about different ones. 1884 was, Blaine went in there clear. Clear sale, nobody contested him. But, Grover Cleveland ended up being the winner in that. And then we had the worst depression in history. That was a disastrous presidency for our nation. I know a lot of people who follow Ron Paul really like Grover Cleveland because he put the United States on a gold standard, but a lot of people don't realize that it wasn't going to a gold standard. It was how he did it. He did it radically overnight rather than shifting toward it in a more gradual form. And when
so the
Machiavellian
approach that he did that.
It was huge. It was one of the worst this was prior to the Great Depression, but it was on par with what we've been going, probably worse even than what we've been going through now. Because there wasn't even a social safety net back then. There were no food stamps, okay? So there were no kind of social welfare programs to take care of you if you were unemployed. So, that was a horrible, horrible depression. And if we had had a better candidate besides Blaine, Grover Cleveland would not have won, and we would not have had what we had. Both their favorite sound monetary policies, but they both favored a gold standard. They had different methods by which they were going to do it. And Grover Cleveland's method was horrible. It was disastrous. And then, another presumptive nominee that just kind of went on without much of a, well, he did have a little bit of a contention, but he went forward in 1916 was Charles Hughes. Now, I got to be straightforward with you. I like many of Charles Hughes' positions, but he couldn't seal the deal on the first ballot, but he did end up becoming the nominee, despite Root, despite Weeks. But we ended up with Woodrow Wilson, okay,
mm-hmm.
Once again, and you had a weak presumptive nominee. That was the problem, all right? The other thing, I don't know how much even of the recent ones, a lot of people go, well, that was the old days, Well, Eisenhower didn't have a clear path. Instead of having multiple ballots, what they would do is they suspend. They have two different tactics they use now, in looking at brokered conventions. The first one, Eisenhower, when Taft had that huge challenge to Eisenhower, is they suspended voting. That began four shifts. And that's how they did that. So you might read where people say, well, Eisenhower did it on the first ballot. What Eisenhower was doing is he was trying to imitate General Grant when he became president. The second time he got it on the first ballot, and they were trying to emulate that.
Mm-hmm.
really tried to do. And while some people say Grant was not an incumbent when he ran the first time, I would argue that effectively he was an incumbent because Andrew Johnson had been impeached. He had been in charge of military reconstruction of the South. So he wasn't really he was not an incumbent in the sense that he was elected, but he was the more or less the reigning commander that people were familiar with. So I would argue that he had a little bit of what I would call the incumbent veneer. If you look at 19, a lot of people like look at 52. Another one to look at is 1968. In 1968, Nelson Rockefeller and Richard Nixon were both, I mean, there was a deadlock there. And what they did is they suspended voting again. Because Nixon had less than 700 votes on the first ballot. All right? He wasn't going to get the nomination. And Reagan, he was a distant third, but he and his small cadre of delegates were able to decide. And what Reagan did is he went to work on the floor on Nixon's behalf. He convinced his delegates to support Nixon, and then he persuaded a huge chunk of Nelson Rockefeller's people to support Nixon. If it hadn't been for Ronald Reagan, Richard Nixon wouldn't have been president.
Wow.
So while it brokered with multiple balloting, what they did is they suspended the balloting. They suspended voting so that they could work things out before the first ballot because it's more about marketing than it is about anything else. Well, if you take a look.
It does seem like it's like a pageant almost when you have when you see the conventions now, it's almost like more pageantry, you know, pomp and circumstance than anything else.
Graduation ceremony that nobody wants to go to. It's not, seriously, you know
that's what they're not really what they're meant to be, correct?
Pardon?
I said, and that's not really what the conventions were meant to be, is a graduation party of sorts. It's supposed to be, you know, hey, let's get the best candidate, you know, to go up against the opponent in, you know, November.
Well, you know,
that's what the convention's supposed to be about.
Just from the perspective of ratings, who was to show up to watch? The only people who watch graduation ceremonies are parents and grandparents. Even the people graduating are kind of in pain being there, all right? And they look for reasons to wiggle out, but they don't because they appreciate the support of their family and they know that their family likes that graduation. Really, the nominating convention, when it's a pageant, is really for the benefit of the supporters of the presumptive nominee. But that's not what the convention is supposed to be about. Nor is it going to be something that attracts attention. People tune in. If you look at sports contests, if you have the top-rated team versus a nobody, but the nobody comes out, like, you know, at the end of the first quarter, they're winning, and they just smear the winning team. You know, usually, like, you know, 10, 20 minutes into the show, people are turning in and watching it, right? But basically, it's just, you know, this is a rubber stick. Well, I'm going to watch it. They're not going to care. And they're going to miss one of the major marketing items that they could possibly have to promote Romney or whoever they want to promote, quite frankly. This is a disaster if they're going to lock out Palin and they're going to lock out Gingrich and they're going to lock out all these other speakers. And right now, that's what the media reports are saying. The media reports are saying that Palin hasn't been invited. She isn't being given a speaking venue. Ron Paul, even Neil Cavuto has said Ron Paul should be as part of the speaking venue. And yet, nowhere is there anything about him speaking. And I've got to be honest, I didn't support Ron Paul. I sure would like to hear him speak, though, you know, because he is a good speaker. And there are a lot of ideas that he does, that he proposes that I like.
Yeah, Barbara, I was actually discussing that with people tonight where they're talking about, there's talk about no Palin talking, there's no Ron Paul talking, and maybe not even Gingrich speaking. Now, through my understanding, is that if Romney does not get the nomination on the first ballot, that opens it up for someone like Palin or Ron Paul or Newt Gingrich or someone else, maybe an Alan West, to take the floor and talk, correct?
Yeah, well, but at the same time, you know, it's going to be rather difficult if they're not even there to speak, quite frankly, because what they'll do is they'll do by a vote by they'll try to do a voice vote by unanimous consent, all right? Unless somebody comes up to the mic and screams, you know, for a point of order and asks for, you know, balloting, which you have to do under Robert's rules. But, you know, unless that happens, they'll just do it by unanimous consent, just move on to some of the business. So it's going to require the delegates being a little bit more involved than just simply showing. I mean, if you're going to the convention, you're just going there for the Romney party, and that's why people are going, then that's not going to be the kind of convention, A, that's going to beat Barack Obama, and B, it's not going to be the kind of convention that I think even the Republican Party wants, you know, because nobody's going to watch it. It's going to be useless airtime.
Exactly. Oh, I agree. Now, there's a question. One of the things I like to do on the show, Barbara, and I'm not trying to interrupt you, I apologize, but I like to try to bring the people in from the chat into the conversation as well. You know, because some people just, you know, aren't comfortable actually calling in, but they still would like to, you know, be heard of what they, you know, have to say, be heard. As I said, it might just be uncomfortable talking on the phone, you know, on, you know, on air. And someone asked, Donna Arthur asked, says, I heard this too, they are locking out Palin. Is it the, here's the question portion, is it the GOP or Romney who is locking her out?
Well, you know, that's very interesting. It's not very clear, but then, of course, Rince Priebus and Mitt Romney are very close. So it sometimes becomes very difficult to distinguish the two. And that's probably Romney telling Priebus no, or maybe Priebus trying to arrange things to lock it down for Romney. I mean, let's be honest, you know, there was a Republican candidate who came to give a nominating speech who was not a candidate. He came, and when he got there, he had to fight the unit rule, and that's how he ended up getting the nomination for president. He wasn't even running. But, you know, he gave such a great speech, and he was able to unify people to fight the unit rule, that he became president. And so, you know, these things have happened historically. They don't want some unknown coming in there and possibly disrupting things.
But what about since both, you know, and of course Santorum, but he's been such a non-issue lately. But we'll give Santorum there. But what about any of the candidates such as Santorum, Ron Paul, and Newt, who they had? And this is another a question from someone in the chat, Donna, is what if, you know, since they have delegates, does that not give them the opportunity to speak since they do have delegates there?
Well, you know, that's what I find rather curious, too. You would think they would. You would think they would do that indeed, but apparently maybe they don't care. You know, and that, again, we're getting back to speaking to, you know, what is the orientation of the GMP? Maybe they don't care about the other voices. And if they don't care, and I'm kind of getting the impression right now they don't care.
Yeah.
And if that's true, the way to really alienate your base and pretty much ensure that people aren't going to get real excited. In fact, they'll be negatively excited, and that's definitely not what you want. The other thing, you know, the Romney camp has...
Can I touch it, Barbara? No, I'm sorry. I just want to ask this. I have an article here. If you do not mind... if you don't mind, if so, continue, and that's fine, because that's why I have you on here tonight. But I have an article here, and it looks like a blog. It says, The Last Refuge, and it says here, I want you to be Andrew Breitbart. I don't know if that's the name of a blog or, you know, what it is, but it says, posted on, by some author. They gave a pseudonym, so you know, that's not really authoritative if they're not giving a real name. But the title of the article says Mittens, so obviously it's a blog. I can't imagine any real news place calling Mitt Romney Mittens. But, you know, this touches on what we're discussing. That's why I'd like to bring it in. So if you don't mind, I'd take the short time to read this.
Go for it.
Okay. It says Mittens throws the election. Report, Mitt Romney banned Sarah Palin from GOP convention. It says, if these reports are true, and so it does, you know, state that if these reports are true, so they're speculating, but it says, Mitt Romney has just pulled out a double-barreled shotgun and shot himself in both feet simultaneously.
Yes.
Says the Romney campaign has not invited former Alaska Governor Sarah Palin to speak at the Republican convention in Tampa. The Romney folks have not even invited her to attend the party's premier event. It's no secret that Sarah Palin does not trust Mitt Romney to hold steadfast to constitutional small governmental principles. No one does. And the same reason why Mitt became the anyone but Obama candidate by default, after failing to get more than 40% support from the self-identified conservative Republicans during the primary season. I contend that 40% is much higher.
Oh,
yeah. If Romney disparages someone who holds the trust of the constitutional majority, he'll be toast. And then it says here something in Washington, D.C. On the day that Mitt Romney formally announced his run for the presidency last year, he found himself competing with a stiff New Hampshire win, which, okay, I'm not seeing where this is relevant, so hold on.
Okay. Well,
I just want to make sure it's, you know, what I'm, you know.
Romney has hired, for example, Andrew Sullivan. Not only is he a member of the elite Pigou Club that is for the green shift, he's for, you know, taxing carbon fuels, but Andrew Sullivan, his special job or his special task within the Pigou Club is to smear anybody who is associated with fossil fuels. And, of course, what is Sarah Palin's signature phrase? Drill, baby, drill, right?
Mm-hmm.
So his job is, of course, to smear her, and he's the founder of something called the Intrigue Truther blogs. And this is where they make up stuff. See, I'm an Alaskan, so I know she was pregnant, all right? I mean,
mm-hmm.
Third. That wasn't pregnant. I mean, she was all over the – she wasn't all over the state because she was working on putting together a heating fuel initiative for that winter. And that had been a very significant task for her that summer. But she was visible enough for people to know that she was clearly pregnant, all right? It wasn't a big secret that she was pregnant. We all knew. She was, I'm going to say we all knew. There are a few people surprised, but basically most people pretty much knew she was pregnant. The rumor mill, what they call, we have in Alaska something called the Indian Telegraph. Word goes by mouth to mouth pretty rapidly throughout this state. It's a big state, but it's a small big state. So, you know, people knew she was pregnant. I mean, you know, she was in her... Yeah. But this guy, Andrew Sullivan, has made a career out of smearing this woman. This is who Mitt Romney has hired on as one of his advisors. That is a serious slap in the face of the state of Alaska.
Wow.
Hello?
Yeah.
Can you
do me a favor, Barbara? For the listening audience, for people who are going to be listening on archives, I think the point you make is very cogent and very important. So if you would please do me a favor by just repeating what you just said about the gentleman who all this time has been after Palin and now he is, you know, seemingly working for Romney. So if you could still repeat that for people, because I think that's a very important point to make to show who, you know, in part who Romney really is.
Well, Romney, you know, he appointed Andrew Sullivan. Andrew Sullivan is the person who promotes this whole trick truther thing, which is aimed at smearing Sarah Palin. And he runs around writing these blogs saying that Trig isn't Sarah's baby, it's really her daughter's baby or some kind of nonsense like that. And we all knew Sarah was pregnant. This is amazingly stupid. And they have a whole YouTube channel and a whole blog, but that's Andrew Sullivan who's orchestrating that. And any other thing he can find to smear Sarah Palin with, he does. And why does he do it? Because he is part of a group based out of Harvard led by Greg Mankiw and Paul Krugman, you know, Smear Bush, Paul Krugman, all right? That group, Al Gore is a member of that group, Stephen Chu was a member of that group, all right? And they are against fossil fuels. So anybody who's associated with a fossil fuel state like George Bush or Sarah Palin, or anybody who is associated with promoting the use of fossil fuels, they target and smear to try to keep them out of power because they want to move their green shift, their green agenda forward. And that's one of the persons that Mitt Romney has appointed. That is like the biggest slap in the face to the state of Alaska that I could possibly imagine is to mm-hmm. appoint Andrew Sullivan any position in your cabinet, Mr. Romney, if you're listening,
I can't say anything against doing anything to protect the environment because I am an environmentalist. Of course, I, I believe in a bottoms-up approach towards environmental protection, conservation, and sustainability, not the top-down that Romney probably favors. I just want to throw that in there for my environmentalist friends out there. You know, when you mentioned that, I mean, I don't have a problem with people being environmentalists and doing things, you know, per se, but the part that's striking for me is that he picked someone who definitely has broken the 11th commandment, the Ronald Reagan 11th commandment, by, you know, appointing someone as an advisor, such as the person who was doing this to Sarah Palin.
Yeah. All right. And it's the same group that went after George Bush. It's the same group that went after Ted Stevens. It's the same group that went after Don Young. All right. I mean, these are organized attacks against people who are in fossil fuel heavy industries, that they do what I call these hit raids on them and attempt to destroy them because they voted for or they advocate for the they're from fossil fuel states. And so obviously they're going to be in favor of fossil fuel policies, right?
What?
I mean,
you're saying Romney has someone who's against fossil fuels on his payroll?
You know, he said, that's what these people are about. That's what this Greg Mankiw is, another one of his advisors. Greg Mankiw and Paul Krugman and Al Gore are besties, okay? And Stephen Chu, these guys all work together with Jeffrey Sachs. And they're it's not a thing. Greg Mankiw's got a blog. I mean, it's right on Harvard's website. He writes about it openly. They openly have lobbyists in D.C., okay? They are doing everything possible to shut down the fossil fuel industry, and they will smear anybody who comes out ahead, who comes out and speaks against them. They call themselves the Pagoon.
And since we're on that subject, you know, why do you think they're trying to shut down the environmental agency? They're trying to shut down the fossil fuel industry. Do you think that it's for true environmental purposes, environmental protection purposes, and sustainability and conservation, or do you think there's another reason behind it?
This is part of their world government agenda, because
through these things
like the Law of the Sea Treaty, okay, which is
Agenda
21. Agenda, that's all the same group of people, okay?
Mm-hmm.
This is part of the global government shift, all right? And that's how they intend, that is another one of their entrees into the encroachment of personal sovereignty. I mean, we're talking about policies so heinous that, for example, in Alaska, we're circulating petitions to prevent the government from banning wood stoves, all right? And this is Alaska, where we get minus 54 for weeks on end, all right?
Mm-hmm.
How could you possibly and the use of wood stoves, and yet that's what we are facing out here, because of the same group of people, that same little Pagoo group that's helping finance the little environmental center that is here in Fairbanks that is precipitating these things. Folks, you know, check around your communities. There's these little environmental centers that they have funded now, and they're causing big problems everywhere. It's not just
And you think that's part of the Agenda 21, correct? Part of the Agenda 21, which is definitely a top-down control, you know, on, you know, way to... But see, I don't believe that Agenda 21 is really the purpose and goal of Agenda 21 is to protect the environment and help with sustainability and conservation. I really do believe it's about control. Yeah.
It's to establish a new feudal order is what it's about. That's what it's about.
That's very great. That's a very good way of putting it. Because I've been saying that for a while. It's like the president becomes the king, and the politicians are the oligarchs, and the American people are the serfs. And then it's going to just spread out to the rest of the world.
Sure. It's, you know, they can't make the rest of the world like the United States. They don't want the rest of the world to be like the United States. They want the United States to be like the rest of the world.
Right.
All right. And that's what we push back and push back hard. But that's kind of getting off our subject a little bit.
It is. And I agree. And we let's get back to the subject. But I do think it's very important. And the reason I say it's very important, you know, beyond the fact that it is that it really ties a lot of things together. And for me personally, it ties a lot of things with what I'm, you know, things I'm trying to do and initiatives I would like to see. And what I like, I'll bring this up shortly, is a paradigm shift that I would like to see is, you know, right now it definitely is, you know, top down, you know, towards environmental protection, sustainability, and conservation. And one thing I would like to see is a paradigm shift where it starts from the ground up, you know, from the people to, you know, take it upon themselves and not have the government, you know, trying to control things and control people, you know, in order for the environment to be protected and have sustainable, you know, a sustainable reality and also, you know, and conservation. So that's something I would like to see, and that's something that, you know, I like
don't
to I promote with the show.
We'll talk to Alaskans about conservation. We've been
what's
conservation.
That?
All right. I mean, we've been conservation to death with, you know, we've got walls that are 4x12, 4x8, 4x6. You know, we've got insulation, you know, more layers of insulation in our homes and our cabins than anywhere else in the United States. And we still have the highest utility rates around because it's illegal for civilians to run the coal, a clean coal-fired plant, but it's perfectly fine for the U.S. military to run a dirty coal plant. All right?
Yeah, there is a definite need for change. Go ahead.
You know, we're not going to agree on that. But as far as the broker convention is concerned, I feel very strongly that we need to begin to consider a different nominee. It's not just how Romney went about getting the nomination. I feel about Mitt Romney the same way I feel about oatmeal. What's with it? Okay? A few raspberries, maybe. Okay? Some sugar? Yeah. Now we're talking something I can handle, right? But if you put oatmeal, what are you going to put with it? Oatmeal? Well, you know, forget it. I'm not interested. Oatmeal with oatmeal is just oatmeal. And putting Bob Portman on the ticket with Mitt Romney is just more oatmeal with oatmeal, really. And keeping these other people out of the convention really is one way to ensure that this convention has the lowest television ratings in the history of the United States. This is insane. Part of the
definitely.
RNC. It's truly insane.
It's going to be Republicans are going to
Think of a bigger debacle. John McCain was oatmeal, okay? But at least they had some nice raspberries to sprinkle on with Sarah Palin. And people watched. And you had attention to the ticket. McCain, if that had been a Palin-McCain ticket, they would have won.
What I found interesting about that is out of all the people who are running in that campaign, she had more executive, you know, experience than any of them. More than McCain, more than, you know, Obama, more than Biden. I mean, she was the only one of all four of them that had executive experience.
Well, and then you take a look at Bob Dole. I mean, Bob Dole is a nice guy. But, you know, if it hadn't been for his wife, nobody would have paid attention.
Oh, my gosh, now, yeah, that was a very boring campaign.
She should have ran Elizabeth. She would have won. You know? But, no, they ran Bob. I mean, not that I don't like him. I mean, it's not about whether I agree with him. There's a point where it has nothing to do even whether you agree with him anymore, okay? There's a point where it's like, later, dude, I'm going to sleep, you need to do something. Romney, and what really irritates me, and I'm sure I'm not the only person who goes through this, whenever you talk about a broker convention, they go, well, you're just voting for Obama. But yet if you take a look at Mitt Romney's own statement, Barack Obama's a nice guy.
Right.
Barack Obama gives you you want free stuff, vote for him. Well, let's see, Mr. Businessman, there's two stores. They look alike to a lot of us. You've got one store. Barack Obama's got another store. You've got a storefront, and you're saying, he's a nice guy. My competitor's a nice guy. He's got free stuff. You want free stuff? Go shop there. Now, over here is Barack Obama's store. Looks kind of the same. Got a different color scheme. All right? He's got free stuff. He's got a promotion going on. All right? And his competitor is telling you what a nice guy he is. Well, to the politically unsavvy person who really doesn't understand a lot of issues, what are they hearing? They're hearing Mitt Romney say, vote for Barack Obama. They're hearing Barack Obama say, vote for Barack Obama. Gee, what message is getting out there, Mr. Romney? Barack Obama, guy. Quit saying, vote for the other guy. Start marketing the free market. Start telling us why your position is better. Start explaining to the American people that the free market has been the engine of growth. It's been the engine of ending poverty. It's been the engine of ending austerity. How the free market solves problems and how you can bring those solutions through an American exceptionalism. Don't tell me to vote for the other guy. That's the last thing I want to hear. Hello? I gave money to that. I gave money to a party that's hawking that in an era where it should be a slam dunk for the Republican nominee. I'm flabbergasted. I'm in shock. I'm furious. I mean, no way should we be giving that guy the nomination at this point, because if that's his marketing strategy, we are not going to win.
No, we're not. What I think the RNC and the establishment thought, they thought this was going to be a slam dunk, and I think that's why they pushed Romney. Because I think that they were like, oh, well, we could finally get, a moderate, a rhino Republican to win in the general election, which hasn't happened in 40 years, And because I think they want to, truly marginalize the conservatives in the party. I think they want the party to be completely taken over by rhinos, by moderate, if not liberal, Democrats. I mean, Republicans. And then it really is going to be like a one-party system. There's communism, right? If you get you get yourself to a one, that might be oversimplifying it, But, exactly what you said. I like Santorum. I kind of like Santorum. I like him better than some others. I like him better than Michelle Bachmann. But one thing that he said that I think was correct was, Romney's the worst candidate that you could have to go up against Barack Obama, and for so many reasons. I think that they thought it was going to be a slam dunk. I think when they start strategizing on this campaign, they really thought that, here's our time. We should be able to take this easy. Well, they're wrong, obviously.
Thomas Dewey was a slam dunk, too. He was a conservative businessman. Who did we get for president in 1948? It certainly wasn't Thomas Dewey.
No, and another thing, he may have been a conservative, but a conservative businessman, but Romney's not. He's not a conservative businessman, that's for certain.
Well, I would argue Thomas Dewey wasn't really a conservative businessman either, but he built himself that way, and so the question, therefore, as somebody who's, I'm just going to take him at his word. I can't go back in history to interview him. Nevertheless, let's just take him at his word for a moment. Just like with Romney, they both are claiming to be conservative businessmen. Okay, I'll take you at your word. Where's the contrast? Where do you differ? Explain free market capitalism to me. Give me your Horatio Alger story. Show me the examples where the free market has led to phenomenal growth and wealth. Show me. Tell me the stories. I know them, okay? I know them well. I'm not hearing Romney talk about them. Now, Romney's assuming people know, but here's what he doesn't realize. You've got a generation of Americans who don't know, who have been told corporations are evil, who have been told corporations are corrupt, who have been told corporate bad, government good. When you get out of high school or college, go to work for an NGO. Don't go to work for a company. All right? You've got a huge generation of Americans who are out there who think that. And he is not accessing them. He's turning them off. And I think that's a disaster.
Oh, I think so. And one thing that I put out there is, those who do not learn, and everyone's heard this phrase, those who have not learned from history are doomed to repeat it. you know, in part of what you pointed out, you know, you've got from 1948 to 2008, you know, so we're not just talking 40 years, we're talking 60 years. I would go back 40 years, but you can even go back 60 years and show that these candidates, well, I say conservative candidates can't win, but, you know, this is a different criteria, or non-conservative candidates. I've said, you know, when you put a moderate candidate such as Romney up for, you know, election, they don't win. Historically, they do not and have not won, you know, the general election.
You go back even to Abraham Lincoln, though. That whole summer, the presumptive nominee was Seward, not Lincoln. Everybody thought Seward had it. He didn't. Okay? It's just like with Benjamin Harrison. Everybody thought all summer somebody else had it. Harrison ended up pulling it out of the bag. He was Mr. Nobody going into the convention. Warren Harding hadn't even left his front porch before the convention. Didn't leave it too much after the convention either. All right? Campaigned from there. And too bad he didn't have YouTube. But, you know, some of these guys, the convention, shoot, Garfield wasn't even running. Okay? Harding was at least running, but he was so below, so far out of it. It would be like, he was nowhere. He showed up with a handful of delegates, and yet he pulled it out at the end. Eisenhower went in there. He didn't have it. All right? Richard Nixon went into the convention. He didn't have it going into the convention. And Ronald Reagan in 1980, when he went into the convention, it looked like he had it. But that was a whole other story. On paper, he had it. But what he didn't realize is how many of those delegates were actually under the control of somebody who wasn't even in. He wasn't even in the process. And that was Gerald Ford controlling the delegates and cornering him into trying to accept him as a co-president. What the guy who was the chairman of the convention was the whole convention blew up. I mean, oh my goodness gracious. There's a tremendously good blog written by a guy who was the chairman of the convention, and his name is Rhodes, all right? And, boy, I encourage people to read that so they can see how they tried to take it away from Reagan, all right?
If you got a link you want to put in the chat, you know, for people can follow that. If you have a link, if not, that's fine, but you could, you know, say it over here. But one thing about Romney is, as pointed out by Donna Author here in the chat, is since Mitt does not have a plan, he says he has a plan, but he doesn't. That's why I, you know, think that you don't hear him giving much specificity about what he's going to do, because frankly, I don't, you know, as Donna Author said, he doesn't have a plan, you know, and how's he going to what's he going to do, take that to the convention and expect to win with all these things going against him, including history?
But see, here's the problem. He technically does have a plan. He just doesn't want to share it.
I'm sorry. He does have a plan. He doesn't want to share it, or?
He does have a plan, but he doesn't want to share it because he can't win on it.
All
right. And remember, the guy who came out and said you shouldn't have a contract for America because it ties you. Yeah. Okay. He doesn't believe in going in with a plan, which is, of course, why he couldn't beat Ted Kennedy. All right.
Right.
Because even everybody, Ted Kennedy had a plan. We didn't like it, but he did have a plan. All right. Romney's going to go in there. It's not going to be much different. I would imagine the first 6 to 8 months will be a breath of fresh air. Will be like, wow, this is awesome. Oh, how nice. We got somebody who knows the Star Spangled Banner, the words, you know.
Yeah.
And but you know, I tell you, there was a couple of races in Alaska, and when I look at what's going on with Obama and Romney, I kind of see them as almost a template, but. Romney is going to have to, he's going to have to realize really very quickly right now that he's going to need the support of the conservative end of the party. There, he has an advisor named Eric Fernstrom that needs to go. Eric Fernstrom.
Yeah, I've heard a lot about
lost,
that guy.
Well, he almost lost Scott Brown's race for him. Scott Brown spent a good chunk of time trying to straighten up and clean up everything that Eric Fernstrom did and finally sent him packing. And I really want to strongly encourage Mitt Romney to consider the wisdom of Scott Brown's actions, because Scott Brown found his ability to win much easier once he was no longer encumbered with Eric Fernstrom. Eric Fernstrom has been a disaster for him. He has come out and contradicted Mitt Romney on more than one occasion and has caused more problems with the conservative end of the party than anybody else in his group of advisors. And if there was anything, if Mitt Romney were to call me up today and say, what is it that I need to do? I would say, first, get rid of Andrew Sullivan. Second, get rid of Eric Fernstrom. Third, get your act together. Get these other voices in the Republican convention, because you can't win without them. And then maybe you can start thinking about actually having the support of the Republican Party in your in your campaign. But the way he's going about it right now, it's like he's locking out Republicans from even supporting him. And this whole idea, this whole tactic of his supporters to say, well, if you don't vote for Romney, you vote for Obama. You know, that's just like inviting us. Is he inviting us to vote for Obama? Is he campaigning for him? Because it certainly is coming across that way between his own personal statements and the statements of many of his supporters in that regard. It's like they're telling us to go vote for Obama. It's like they want us to. And I don't want to vote for Obama. But,
no,
you know,
neither
the way
do I. And that's one of the reasons why we're fighting the way we are. But, and that's why we're fighting so much for, you know, a broker convention, because we know Romney can't beat Obama, and so what we're striving for, you know, is a candidate such as, for me, it's Newt Gingrich, you know, to be, who can actually, because they will show such a stark contrast with themselves and Romney that they can actually beat him in November.
Well, you know, but I tell you, it's going to be a tough fight at the convention, and the key to this whole thing is the heart of the delegates, and if you have a chance, go right to, if you know the delegates in your state, or if you know the state, the national committeeman in your state, you know the state party chairman in your state, don't sue them. Write them. Persuade them. Market your position to them. Whatever it is, tell them what, who you support. Tell them you don't want Romney. 70% of the Republicans in the primaries did not want Mitt Romney. And who do
right.
we now have as Republicans? Nominee, Mitt
exactly.
Romney.
Exactly.
This is the time.
Well, because they've been lied to by people on, like, on Fox News, and I call Fox News, F-A-U-X, you know, and Rush Limbaugh, and, you know, one, his inevitability, which is a self-fulfilling prophecy that they're pushing for. Two, is that, oh, well, Romney's the only one who can win. Yeah, that's painting out to be, you know, not true, you
what?
Know.
Robert, let me ask you something. If he has it in the bag, why does he have to keep telling us that?
Right. Right.
Curious. If he has it in the bag, why does he have to keep repeating it? Why do they have to keep repeating it over and over? You know, was it Adolf Hitler said? That if you tell him why loud enough, long enough, the people will believe it, right? That's
exactly. Yep.
They have it. That's why they have to keep repeating that they have it, because they're not sure. They don't really know.
Yeah, it's unfortunate how, you know, and you have all this knowledge of the history of the broker convention, and what while I still did listen to, you know, and watch, you know, Fox News, was I've never heard anything about it. And I haven't seen any articles or anything pop up about broker conventions either coming from, you know, from the so-called conservative media outlets.
And yet, who was the first person to even bring up the idea of a broker convention? It was Ann Coulter.
Yeah, which I find ironic. I never was and probably never will be an Ann Coulter fan. I think she's just too out there, you know, for me at least, you know, but I'm just never a big fan of hers.
She's not a conservative. She's a Democrat who became a Republican because she got chased out by the Marxists in her part in the Democratic Party. But she's not a Republican. She's conservative. This whole notion that she's some kind of conservative is I find bizarre and strange and weird, because she's not a conservative. she was for many years a Democrat. She was conservative as Democrats go, but she was not conservative as Republicans go. And that is, of course, a very big distinction, because a conservative Democrat is very much like a liberal Republican. So what part of the party do you think she is aligned with? Duh. You know, I don't know. The GOP, you know, there was a little bit of talk for a while, and there were some feelers put out there for a while by some of the people in the Bush family about, well, you know, we had a brokered convention. Who could we get in there? And, you know, as much as I love and respect the Bush family, the branding problem that happened with them because of Paul Krugman and because they failed to respond to it, they chose to ignore it, has really made it almost impossible for Jeb Bush to even make an entry into the political arena beyond the state governorship, you know. And that's really sad and unfortunate, you know, but it is what it is. But, you know, really, they really need to really rethink having Romney in there. And, you know, Chris Christie is not a solution either. I mean, people would suddenly love Romney all over again because of Chris Christie. I mean, in fact, if Romney wants to make sure he gets the nomination, he needs to send Chris Christie to, like, I don't know, ice him for a month.
Well, speaking of that, here's an interesting thing. Mark just puts an article in the chat, which I'm going to read. It's a short article, and I'd really love to get your thoughts on it. Keep forgetting today's Monday, but July 16th, 2012, this is Newsmax, okay? New York Times, Romney has made decision on VP pick. See, now, let me make this disclaimer before I read this article. Isn't normally when you make a VP pick, it's closer to the end of the convention, and that's, you know, to build up the excitement, you know, towards who that could be? And I think the reason why Romney is pushing this, you know, but he's picking in the news, like Fox News or whatever, is pushing that, you know, the whole VP, you know, story is because I think what they're trying to do is by using this to push the narrative that, you know, he is the official, that Romney is the official nominee. It's because only the official nominee will pick a vice presidential candidate, right? So by saying it now before the convention, I think they're trying to feed into the narrative, you know, of Romney's, you know, being the actual nominee instead of still remaining the presumptive nominee.
They're trying to trump the convention is what they're trying to do.
I'm sorry?
Trump
I missed that last
convention.
Part.
They're trying to make the convention irrelevant.
Very, very good point. Trying to make and for obvious reasons, you know, they want to make the convention irrelevant. So I'm going to go on and read this article here, and I'd really love to hear your thoughts. It says, Mitt Romney has reached a decision on who will be his vice presidential running mate and may announce it this week, the New York Times reported. The information about Romney's decision was part of an article spotlighting former Minnesota Governor Tim Pawlenty, 51, who is one of several possible candidates for vice president. Romney has embraced the advice of Pawlenty and has forged a close relationship with him, the Times reported. Pawlenty has become one of Romney's most vocal backers and was described by the National Review as Romney's traveling salesman. I'm happy to help where I can, Pawlenty told the Times. Asked about the number two slot, Pawlenty told the paper, I think I can best serve him in other ways, but anyone would be honored to be asked. Several Republicans
stop right there. What did that sentence say?
I'll read it. It says, Pawlenty told the paper, I think I can best serve him in other ways, but anyone would be honored to be asked.
That was a no. That was a very polite no. That was a polite no.
And it ends in a little bit. It says, several Republicans close to the Romney campaign told the Times they believe Pawlenty and Senator Rob Portman of Ohio stand out among those being considered. A quote, I guess, from Ray Washburn says, an appealing counterbalance to Romney being the son of a wealthy man and going to elite schools in Palenty, being the son of a truck driver who went to the University of Minnesota. Ray Washburn, a Dallas Bisman Tool Times. He's not elite in any sense of the word. I guess he's speaking of Palenty. So
he's
if you wish to, would please chime in about that, that would be great.
Oh, my. I thought that was the most polite no I've heard for a long time. He can serve in plenty of other ways. I can serve you in a lot of other ways. That's my way of, that's his way of politely saying no.
Good, but what about the thought of they're even trying to? You mentioned it. A part of it. We could get some more elaboration on it about, you know, why you think the timing of it is significant.
Well, they're trying to make the convention irrelevant. That's what they're trying to do.
Mm-hmm. And you think that's because there's actual concerns starting to creep up about an actual broker convention?
I think there is. So I think they're trying to trump it. He's got a group of advisors who really just don't understand. They think they can manipulate the people. That's what he's got in his inner circle. He's got a group of people who really believe they can manipulate people through blogs and through the alternate media. And one of the things that, you know, Romney, back when Breitbart was still alive, Romney was constantly furious about Andrew Breitbart. I don't know how many people realize this. It was Romney who was constantly furious about Breitbart and thought Breitbart needed an editor. In fact, he thought all these blogs out there needed some kind of editor. I don't know how many people don't. That was in the Hill blogs back not long before, either not long or not long after Andrew Breitbart died. And while a lot of people think Barack Obama might have, you know, done something to Andrew Breitbart, I think Romney had just as much of a motivation, perhaps more so, to go after Breitbart than, you know, say, for example, Barack Obama ever might. Because Barack Obama just simply ignores Breitbart. I mean, that's his way of handling it, right?
From my understanding, because people who are running Breitbart right now aren't doing so in a way that Breitbart might be too happy about. Just things that I've heard. But.
Right. Well, you know, and again, that gets back to that whole who's in there from the pagoda. See, and this is why I'm very selective about what shows I appear on, too, Robert, because...
Well, thank you. I appreciate that.
You know, I am, because, you know, this Pagoo Club and the Pagoo Circle, they do have a very strong presence in the alternate media. And that's why David Cholesterol has this whole alternate media, alternate to the alternate media group, because there is a group out there. They are not just using Fox, but they're using all the blogs as well. And they've sort of established this, what I call this this establishment set of blogs now to... present certain different viewpoints and positions to be more of an extension now of the main media rather than
mm-hmm.
being independent media, which is what Breitbart was striving for. So, and again, and that's allowing that select Pagoo group, those anti-fossil fuel, anti-drilling, anti-clean coal, they're just against economic development, you know? I mean, how weird is it that we have a country where somebody like Stephen Chu, okay, is the secretary of the Department of Energy, right? And he doesn't even drive a car, so he wouldn't have a clue what gas prices are. And it wasn't until people started griping the gas prices, and I don't know about other places in the world, but up here they've dropped about $1 over the past 3 months. All right?
Wow.
I'm wondering if this even happened. If we hadn't made a huge amount of noise.
How much is a gallon of gas up there in Alaska?
Well, now it's around $3.99.
Okay, wow, so it's about $5 a gallon up there?
It had been.
Wow.
Well, heating fuel in March was $5.17 in Nenana, Alaska, which is on the road system, right by where the barges are. I mean, we've got our whole state shut. I mean, we've had development shut down right and left, you know, up here. And what is going on up in Alaska is really, particularly in the interior, it's criminal and it's catastrophic. And I wish there was a way to somehow convey what's going on up here in a way that people could understand, because they always do it up here before they do it elsewhere. truth. That's they practice up here.
Kind of like a proving ground to work.
Yeah, practice the methodology up here. I mean, the first snatch and grabs on the whole gun issue was actually over a guy, Jim Wilder, and it was by the National Park Service on the Yukon River. But, you know, that most people aren't even aware of it. It was a 73-year-old man they decided to pick off, okay, on the Yukon River over. And anybody has time to Google a story, wants to see the opening salvo. I mean, I don't think Barack Obama had been in office very long when that all went down. And it's just, that was just the opening salvo. There's instance after instance after instance. This was long before the Department of Homeland Security was doing what it's doing at the airports, but that was what their opening salvo. And they used the National Park Service, not the Department of Homeland Security. Well, it's the same basic thing. You know, strip searches and whatnot. And this guy was just floating home across the Yukon River in the most remote part of the world, I might add. So, you know, they usually practice it up here pretty good before they do it down there.
Well, you know, I know my hope is that these different things, you know, coming about Mitt Romney, you know, with Bain Capital, and it looks like they might be looking more at this with the time when Bain Capital was a part or managing Damon Corporation. Are you familiar with that? With
you know,
Medicare fraud and Damon Corporation?
Oh, very much. I do know a little bit about the Medicare fraud, but you better believe that, you know, I guess I'm more worried, you know, Pat Dollard, I guess, had, as on her blog, had some of the papers from 2000 that showed that Romney was still in the filings. Now, I think the 2001, Romney might be able to get around by saying it was a fiscal year, not a, that he was filing those papers for the fiscal year. But I think he's going to have an incredibly hard time arguing it because he said he left in February of 99. And everybody knows that fiscal years begin after the regular calendar year. So here he is as late as, you know, June of 2000, still showing up doing the paperwork and doing the filing. Now, I think he might be able to wiggle out of that one because it's still pretty close to the time. You know, you could argue that he was cleaning up the paperwork from his time there, right?
Mm-hmm.
But I think if they have him, on 2001, they have him on 2002. Then I think they got him on a felony charge, for sure. Now, I don't know if they have that or not. But I'm going to tell you something.
My hope is that he steps down before the convention. We can get somebody who can actually beat Obama in there.
They're not going to do that. They're not going to release it until after the convention. And here's why. If they release it before the convention, then they will pick a different nominee, and they'll have to retool their whole marketing.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Right now they've got all their marketing laid out, all right? They've got their whole thing ready to roll out for the day after the convention. They'll probably start with the marketing.
And Barbara, I'm sorry for interjecting here, but I've got to say this. That's why when the people who are out there are saying, oh, my gosh, a broker convention would be a disaster, not only the history that you've, you know, well put out and well described, you know, the benefits of what a broker convention would do and the history of it, you know, is the people who are out there saying how much of a disaster it would be for a broker convention. One is what you just described, why it would be good. Two, I mean, it would put the Obama administration scrambling to, you know, try to, you know, get their new attack ads and attack strategy, as you pointed out, you know, to the new nominee. You know, I mean, a broker convention, it would be nothing but a good thing for the Republican Party.
Yeah, but you get somebody who has the genuine support of the people. If you look time and time again, the people who came out of a broker convention, the people really did, in the end, support that person. And they voted overwhelmingly for them in the general election. And they went on to become very well-loved. Now, one or two of them, Harding, I've actually walked the ice trail. He was on there. Some people say he was poisoned. Some people say he died of other causes. He did walk an ice trail up here, and I went down and kind of checked out that ice trail down by the Exit Glacier, and I could see how that would make somebody sick if he drank some Giardia water. But either way, I mean, both Harding and I guess Garfield both met their demise not long after they were nominated. They didn't get a chance to make the changes they wanted to make, but both of them were in favor of serious reforms. And in the case of Garfield, his vice president, Chester Arthur, who had been Roscoe Conkling's hack, even rose to the occasion, an ultimate product of the hack system, rose to the occasion and signed the Pendleton. We got the reforms. We're not going to get reforms with Mitt Romney. He says his R is for reform, but I'll tell you what, we're not going to get reforms. There's no, he says he's going to repeal Obamacare, and I got to be honest, I doubt it. He's got the guy who organized the exchanges as one of his advisors. If that's true, then why does he have the guy who organizes the exchanges as one of his advisors? He wouldn't need him as an advisor if he wasn't going to implement it.
Exactly. And the sad thing is, the sad thing is, Barbara, is no one, I can't say no one, we are, there's just not enough people paying attention to it, and this is what makes me so angry, with the so-called conservative media, because they're not going to talk about this. They're not talking about it, none that I've heard. I mean, yeah, I've stopped pretty much listening to it, but I've got other ways of hearing what, Fox News and Rush Limbaugh, are talking about, without actually have to physically listen to them. And they're not vetting Romney. I mean, go ahead.
John Boehner has said, you've probably heard this. I've got one of the videos I produced has Boehner saying this. Boehner says, he's got a few people who will vote for him, some Mormons and some family.
Right.
But the American people aren't going to vote with him. Well, this election is going to be about supporting or rejecting Barack Obama. Well, let me tell you something. If you take a look at the theory, there's a whole body of knowledge out there called epistemology that I encourage the Republican Party to please get involved in. Please look at a little bit of Vimir Lakatos' work. All right? You need a competing paradigm to drive out a paradigm. You can't just have a referendum no on Obama and expect people are going to vote for Romney. That's not how it's going to work. You have to have something to vote for. People will come out to vote for something. They won't come out to vote against something.
Right, because they have to be motivated, right.
Because that's historically been the challenge of conservatism, is that you have to build something you go out and vote for. You vote for America. You vote for free markets. You vote for liberty. You vote for the sovereignty and the ability to pursue your dreams. That's what you're voting for. And they got to learn to make the case of what they're voting for. And the problem is, Romney's people don't believe in that stuff. And that's why they can't make the case for it. And that's why they have nothing to vote for. People to vote against, say, just stay home. 2006, they voted against the Republican Party. They stay home. And the Democrats ran the polls. That's how we got Pelosi and Reid. Again, they're going to make the same mistake this year if they don't have something to vote for. All right? And I'm not seeing the image of what to vote for. All I'm hearing was a lot of, you want free stuff? Vote for him. He's such a nice guy. Vote for him. We just can't afford him anymore. This is the rich guy saying we can't afford him anymore. Come on, really? Give me something to vote for. I can't vote for plain oatmeal. I can't vote for wallpaper paste drive. Either get a program or get the guy out of there, and let's get somebody who can win this thing, because this country cannot afford four more years of Obama. And right now it's looking like if I vote for Romney, I'm voting for Obama, and that is not what I want to do.
Right. Yeah, me either. And there's a whole host of people out there, Barbara, who are saying that they will not vote for Romney under any circumstance. And some are saying, and we've talked about the VP, and some are saying the only way they would vote for Romney is if Newt Gingrich was on the ticket, or, of course, other people. Well, I've never heard anyone say, if Ron Paul is on the ticket, but I think for Paul supporters that may very well be the case. I mean, and very well not, because a lot of Paul supporters said if he's not on the top, they won't vote for him at all. They'll go for Gary Johnson or somebody of that nature. So there's a whole host of people who, just for one reason or another, just refuse to, you know, refuse to vote for Romney. And some of those refuse to vote for Romney because they believe Romney is still not pro-life, especially when you have Romney going to, you know, the home of the CEO, the manufacturer of the day after pill, you know, to get $50,000 plate fundraiser.
Joe, isn't that amazing? Well, I'm going to tell you something else too. There's a lot of Democrats out there who don't want to vote for Obama, okay? And they're not going to vote for Romney. They'll vote for Paul. They'll vote for Newt. Some of them would have even gone the extra step to vote for Santorum because he would be fun, okay? Not because they liked it, but he would be fun. They know they can have fun with Santorum, all right? They know they can poke him, all right, and make fun of him and get good ratings out of him. They could have lived with Newt. They liked Paul. They don't really want Obama back. They don't like the NDAA. They don't like all these anti-liberty things that are going on. And these are Democrats, not libertarians. They don't like a lot of this stuff that's going on with Obama either. Okay? Just because you're a Democrat doesn't mean you don't love the Constitution. Doesn't mean you don't advocate free speech. I mean, they don't like SOPA or PIPA either. Okay? Some of these issues go beyond party lines. SOPA, PIPA, I can go through the list. Newt Gingrich came out and said he was against SOPA. That was the best thing he could have did for his candidacy, quite frankly. But I'm going to tell you something. They won't vote for Romney because they see him as actually worse than Barack Obama. All right?
Right, and the independents won't either, because unless you show a stark contrast between the candidates, and once Romney's true record starts getting vetted after the convention, after that gavel drops, and it's definitely too late, unless somehow he would drop out, but that would never happen. You know, then they're really going to start, vetting Romney's record. And once that gets out to the general public, and you have your independents out there, they're gonna be like, well, wait a minute, there's not a dime difference between these two guys. They're going to be more apt to vote for the devil they know than the devil they don't know.
Yeah, that's right.
Because then it becomes the lesser of the two evils.
Well, and there's a lot of people who think that if we get a hold of the Senate, we can mitigate any damage Barack Obama does. Well, I don't believe that to be true. I think Barack Obama, you know, we're gonna have to have impeachment hearings first off, because you drop the veil of executive privilege once you have those impeachment hearings. That's the point of the impeachment hearing. Now, if we ultimately end up impeaching him, so much the better. Okay, that's why I wanted early tapes to win that in a primary slot, because I knew that was one thing I could rely on Orly to do was. to go after Barack Obama.
Yeah, I was really disappointed about Orly not getting that, and I'd like to get in contact with her at some other point, because I still think she can, you know, be helpful and relevant in moving forward and getting some things done. Now, Donna also comes in also, and I'd like for you to speak of this, is about this as the question. I think it was more of a rhetorical question, but more of a statement than a question, but I could be wrong. But it's, you know, why did Soros like the fact Romney was running and even endorsed him?
Well, George Soros has got an agenda. And explain to you what that agenda is. I don't know how many people know about it. He wants to make the world currency the renminbi, okay, or at least in the – and if you look at something called an SDR, it's a global currency that's been around since the 60s. It's kind of like fake gold. It's a basket of weighted currencies. In his mind, the renminbi needs to be reweighted to be the heavier valued currency and to become the new world currency. That's what he wants to see. He also, the renminbi is his preferred currency. He also wants to see most of this new world government, the new world order facilities like the UN and all these other things. He wants to see a move to either Argentina or Chile. Because he thinks it's perhaps a better avenue for.
I like Chile.
Sure. Well,
I like the Chile idea, because I love Chile, especially with beans and onions, maybe a little cheese on top.
for the nation. That's St. Louis.
I know. I'm just being. I'm just interjecting a little humor, like I want to do sometimes. You mentioned Chile, and I'm like, oh, Chile. I like Chile. Go ahead. I digress. I know, but I just like to throw humor in there a little bit. Go ahead.
This whole world operation, if you will, to be based on basically Argentina and Chile. Okay, it's just the focus of economic development. He also says the U.S. economy is going to continue to be a drag. All right, that's cool. Well, here it is. That's what Soros wants to do. So he's looking at the candidate who will best accommodate that agenda. And in his mind, either candidate will accommodate that agenda just fine. As long as he can see the demise of the United States, the unilateral disarmament of the United States, he wants to see weapons taken out of the United States, so that we can become basically peasants in our own land, okay, to establish the new world order, which in no way is nothing new. It existed back in the days of feudalism. I don't see it being particularly new. I guess it's a higher technology version of it, but it's still peasants.
Well, it's global feudalism, and that's where it's the new order. I mean, it's not, as you said, it's not quite new, but I mean, it's instead of it just being in some fiefdoms, you know,
right.
You have, it's global.
Right, and it's got a new veneer to it, you know. You still have the masses being entertained by the court jesters. In this case, it's Justin Bieber and Lady Gaga. Okay, they're not there.
Yeah.
No, I'm no, serious. Is that not what it is? They are? They're entertainers. They're entertaining the masses. And you know, there isn't anybody. There isn't a value for brilliance and exceptionalism. There is a reward for dependency and obedience. So, that's the kind of world they want to see. It's the kind of world I want to see. All right. You know, and that's not the kind of world I want. I don't think Newt called it managing the decline. I thought he was being very polite when he said managing the decline. The reason why he was so totally opposed to a Newt Gingrich, or why he thought it was a radical change, is because Newt Gingrich does talk about America being magic, America's exceptionalism,
ooh,
you know, opportunities and
go ahead
for just entry into the marketplace. And that's what really became very unsettling to George Soros, because George Soros doesn't believe that just anybody should be able to enter the marketplace.
Hey, Donna.
Fact,
I keep calling you Donna because Donna's in the chat. Go ahead, Barbara.
He sees, you know, George Soros sees government as a tool for him to protect his market share. He does not. He government is something that protects everybody's sovereignty. You know, Soros has a very Hobbesian view of the world where people live in the mud and primitiveness and destroy each other without government.
Well, except the oligarchs in the right. Except people like you are in his position.
Well, that's why you have people in his position, right? That's what made the nobles noble, right?
Right. You mentioned something that I like to play a clip about. As you mentioned, Newt, you know, saying, you know, he thinks America is magical. And one thing about Newt is I think you would agree is that just hearing him talk is motivational. Not just a skill, but it's just something about the man that Romney does not possess.
Are you playing
the
version by your friend Tommy? Are you playing the version by your friend Tommy?
I'm not sure. Let's find out. Let me play it. It just has the title of the clip that I gave it. And if it is, let me know. If it's not, let me know too, okay?
Okay.
It's about 4.5 minutes. So it could very well. But let's find out.
America is magic. It's why cynics and academics and Europeans and others never quite understand this. And we're magic because we really do believe that we can be a city upon a hill. We really do believe that we have been endowed by our Creator. And that isn't an act of arrogance. It's an act of humility. Because it means we have a responsibility. We are people who have been placed on this planet with the opportunity to extend freedom all the way to every human being. We care about people so much, that if there's a tsunami in Indonesia, we're there. If there's an earthquake in Turkey, we're there. If there's a hurricane in Honduras, we're there. Part of us has a tear every time a child is lost anyway. That's why if you watch our news, we pay such intense attention when children are lost. Because every single child is a child of God. We've gotten off on the deep end. And we've done this before, honestly. And we're in a little bit of a mess. And we've had a weak period of political leadership. And we have bureaucracies that think they're Europeans and that we're only subjects and they can order us around. And we have judges who are alienated and think that they actually represent some international worldview superior to the Constitution. And we have a news media that reflects the academic world and an academic world that reflects a fantasy of the left. And so all those things come together. And we have some problems. We are the wealthiest, most extraordinary society in the history of the human race. At this very moment, we are the largest economy by a large scale. We are capable of pulling away from China as decisively as in the 1990s we pulled away from Japan. We have the most powerful military in the history of the world. But we have to come back to grips with a decision about who we are. And what I would say to every young person here tonight is, you're at the edge of a revolution in scientific knowledge that is going to liberate you in the next half century, fully as much as any generation in American history. And I'll close with a person I admire a great deal that Cliff and I did a movie about, Ronald Reagan. Ronald Reagan was born when he had horse cattle. When we went out and filmed the movie, and we were at the ranch, I saw it, and the ranch was very small, 1950s style building. I saw this picture on the wall that I'd never seen before. It was Ronald Reagan in the 1930s, in a U.S. cavalry uniform, not from a movie, but from an Army Reserve unit. Reagan was in one of the last horse cavalry units in the U.S. Army, as a reserve officer. He'd grown up. He was born before motion pictures had sound. He went to Hollywood when Technicolor was brand new. He evolved into television, which had not existed. And he spoke to the nation about the explosion of a space shuttle and the death of a teacher in space. All in one lifetime. And so he believed that you ain't seen nothing yet. I would say to every young person here tonight, we will be back. We will rebuild the country we love. And we will save the planet. You ain't seen nothing yet.
Tell me that you... Okay, folks. The music was a little distracting, as I put in the chat, but I wish it was without the music. Maybe I could find a clip with just his voice in it talking. Yeah, but be that as may, you know, I'm sure you heard most of it as I did. And, you know, he's just such a motivational speaker. And he just has something that you could tell is coming from within him. It's genuine. I mean, that's the first word that comes into my mind when I hear Newt Gingrich speak is it's genuine. And you can hear his genuine respect, his genuine, you know, love and fervor for America.
And yet, I don't know how many people remember Robert Stern, who ran a lot of the states for Newt page, like, you know, Hawaii for Newt, Alaska for Newt, go through the whole for Newt thing. He has a bunch of Newt groups. And you know what he posted just a little bit ago? Could someone explain the rationale for supporting Newt? Having worked on Newt's campaign, I am now a little baffled. It's over. We were told by Newt it's over. We were told by his campaign managers it's over. I don't think he's even going to the convention. He has bowed out. I have not heard he's going to the convention. Can someone please tell me how that anyone may think Newt is going to win next month at the convention? That's from Robert Stern. He's not listening. They are so embedded in the Romney campaign, they can't even get their heads out of the storm long enough to see the truth. All they can see is Iranian Republican guards at the border in Venezuela, they don't see that Romney doesn't have the experience or the ability to deal with any of this stuff. They really don't. And that is something we have to fight. That's where we have to take the battle. I hope that people who are here, who are listening, who are part of the chat, they need to get in there. We need to start getting in there, and they need to start building new. Doesn't matter if he's going to the convention. In fact, in past times in history, the person being nominated wasn't at the convention. Or the person nominated showed up at the convention. They weren't even there running. They were there nominating. They were there, but they had like 5 delegates or something, you know. We have got to open people's eyes. We have to take the battle onto the new pages, onto the new lists, and we have to start really getting out there and getting the word out there that we do have a change. We do have a choice. It's all up to the delegates. The delegates
right.
run the. It's the delegates who run the convention, and it's the delegates who can set this straight. The heart of the delegates is where it's at. And
right.
people want a different nominee, and there's a very compelling case for it, then now is the time to make your stand. Now is the time to get out there, start writing your national committeemen, write your delegates in your state, write them, start lobbying, start telling them anybody but Romney, or telling them whoever it is that you want. Even if you want Ron Paul, you want Newt Gingrich, you want Rick Santorum, I don't care. If you don't start writing now and getting the word out there, you are going to be stuck with Mitt Romney. It's time to start letting the heart of the delegates know. And you do that, the only way to override the outcome, the presumed outcome of these primary votes, is for people in droves to start writing their national delegates. Write your delegates, write your delegates, write your national committee man, write your national committee woman, write your state party chairman. Don't threaten, don't be mean, don't file lawsuits. Just simply express your opinion and tell them why you think that Mitt Romney is wrong and why you think your guy is good, or whichever people you're supporting or you think would be good. Let them know who they are. This is the time.
Exactly. And I've said this many times, Barbara, is that the fate of the United States and its people, children and grandchildren, and I truly believe this, truly in my heart of hearts believe this, that the very fate of the United States and where we are going to go forward, are we going to go down the precipice with Obama? Are we going to have the slow decline of a Romney? You know, maybe not a slow decline, but a slower decline. You know, just in managing the decline from a Romney. The fate of not us, but our children and grandchildren are in those delegates' hands. And when those delegates can realize the importance of what their vote is going to be, now are you going to vote for your children, your grandchildren? Is your vote going to be for them, or is it going to be for the party? Is it going to be about principles? Or is it going to be about the party? Now, what's most more important, the party or principles, or your children and grandchildren or principles, or the party?
And it isn't just the party; it's the nation. Because I'm going to tell you, there are droves of Democrats who don't want to vote for Barack Obama, but they will not vote for Romney. They'll vote for any of the other 3 nominees, but not for Mitt Romney. And that's what people have to realize. They're not going to vote for Chris Christie. They won't vote for Jeb Bush. Not because there's anything wrong with Jeb Bush except his last name. And
exactly.
You're
not going to have another dynasty now.
No. And, you know, out of principle, really, they shouldn't. And I think even Jeb has realized that. But we don't want a Rubio. We want, even a Palin would be fine. I mean, a Newt Palin ticket, a West Palin ticket, a Gingrich West ticket, any of them would be fine. But there's no indication right now that Alan West or Sarah Palin or any of these people are even going to be included in the convention. And it makes me wonder if they even really want to win. Because if they wanted to win, they would be going out of their way to be as inclusive as possible to all of the elements. Even Neil Cavuto, who has been one of the staunchest Romney supporters from the beginning, has been an absolute that Ron Paul hasn't been given the speaking venue at the Republican convention. And if anybody would be given a forum to speak, you would think it would be Ron Paul. Because he, behind Romney, had perhaps one of the more significant, certainly the most vocal contingent in the Republican Party. And you would think he would want to keep those younger, more enthusiastic Republicans that were coming
right
into the pipe.
That's true,
I mean,
too. That's going to be another part of the future of the party.
And what they did is they totally turned those people off. Totally. And completely. I mean, I'm seeing them go back into the Libertarian Party.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
yep.
People
they have
to say,
talk about Gary Johnson.
Mm-hmm. You can say, well, good riddance to them, blah, blah, blah.
No.
This isn't a year that we can say good riddance. This is a year that we have to say, stand with us, help us, all right? This isn't a year that we go, well, if you want free stuff, all right, go vote for the other guy. He's nice. What? I mean, really, that is the strangest campaign strategy I've ever heard in my life. Really? They think that's going to win?
Exactly. You know, it's... You know, it's a heavy sigh because it does get frustrated about, you know the people and how... In a way, you know, I don't really feel sorry for them because of personal responsibility. But... They've really drank the Kool-Aid. You know what I mean when it comes to Romney. They really took a hook, line, and sinker from your Fox News and your Rush Limbaughs and you know Glenn Beck and you know they really took the bait and now they're running with another like you know one of the things I say kind of throw a little humor in is you know they drink the Kool-Aid to become Romney zombies and now you just hear Romney. You know it's like. They don't look at anything else. You know what I'm saying?
Well, here is the point, though. And even Michelle Malkin, who has perhaps been one of the most ardent Romney supporters out there since Rick Santorum.
Oh, my God.
Right?
Yeah, and she calls herself a conservative?
Yeah, and yet even she has even said, Romney needs to stop saying Barack Obama's a nice guy. Romney has to quit saying, you want free stuff, go vote for the other guy. He's got to quit campaigning for Barack Obama and start campaigning for America, for his presidency. And he hasn't started that. It doesn't seem to be happening. Okay, well, it's you know, I'm going to be honest with you. It's just like Ron Paul's candidacy. You know, I would have thought with Ron Paul's candidacy, you know what kind of ads I thought I would have heard? I thought I would have heard ads like... educating the people about the NDAA, educating the people about the Federal Reserve, educating people about fluoride in the water. You know, I would have thought I would have heard all of these kind of ads, right? But yet, the only ads I really saw for Ron Paul were the serial hypocrisy ads about Newt Gingrich and Rick Santorum. And in the final analysis, Ron Paul even came out and said, you know, he thought Newt Gingrich is probably the better of the other three candidates.
Well,
you know?
Well done. Well, Barbara, well, I hate to say this, but I'm looking at the time, and I've only got a minute and a half before the show. I mean, it's definitely been very instructional, very informational, and I'd love to have you come back because I'm sure you have a lot more knowledge and information and history that you can impart on us. So I thank you very much for coming to the show. I thank you for all the listeners. I thank you for all the people in chat who contributed as well. And also like to thank people going to be on the archives, and that will end this show the way I end every show, and that is with a song from a singer who I really like. And she's got a beautiful voice, and her name is Aubrey Ashburn, and I suggest checking out her website at www.aubreyashburn.com. And thank you very much, Barbara, once again for coming in, and I look forward to speaking to you another time.
Thank you.
Thank you. Take care. Good night, folks.